Hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
Lead us not into temptation, but receive from them. All may be seated wisdom. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Okay. Well, today I'm going to sit down, which I should have done all the time anyway. Okay. In essence, since it's the last session, what we're trying to do is here wrap up certain things and give quite specific instructions and incentives for purposes of evangelization. And perhaps, and I've thought about this, maybe this should have been the first session and the one that was first should have been last. But again, what we tried to drag all the way through this, constantly referring back to it, is the concept of truth and the value of truth and the common thread of truth. And again, what we did was, after we established that, we dealt with some basic instrumentalities by which one learns truth, basic doctrines. The last session we dealt with personalities of non and ex-Catholics. And now, as I say, this is sort of a call to action. I think in rhetorical terms, it's called an exhortation. And what I'm going to try to present here is essentially the position which I think Catholics don't ever use for evangelization. In other words, I'm going to try to emphasize a strength which we never use and we totally ignore. What we rely on tremendously is the concept of intellectual truth. What I'm going to try to argue is that we should rely in not just on intellectual truth, but on emotional truth, or what might call natural truth, or what can be simply summed up as feelings. And in order to try to establish that, I want to start off with two brief stories, one of which is true and a fact in history, recent history, and one of which is from a movie and therefore fiction and art. But they both deal with the same issue, and they both get the same principle across. Everybody knows Norman Schwarzkopf, or at least knows the name, obviously the general who was the victorious commander during the Desert Storm thing. And, of course, as was happening, because it was so popular that he was brought into Congress to address this joint session of Congress, and he did. And he said, among other things, in his prepared statement, or at least his release statement, that he prayed that God would grant the light judgment on those who fell in the military operation. Now, I want you to just keep that phrase in mind, a light judgment. And remember who Norman Schwarzkopf is. Here is a man who at least that time was being advanced as a possible presidential candidate, certainly was summarizing the feelings of the American public, and certainly couldn't, because of either political or social considerations, not say anything that would be unacceptable. In other words, what he said had to be universally accepted. Now also understand that Norman Schwarzkopf isn't anything but Catholic Protestant. Someone asked in one of these Sunday magazines what his religious affiliation was. I can't remember what they said it was, but he says he goes to whatever Protestant church is on base. So anything but a Catholic-type Protestant. Keep those two things in mind, what he said and the context of it. The second thing I refer to is a movie, and I think it was called Lassie Come Home. It was one of those Lassie movies. Everybody knows Lassie. Lassie's the collie dog. And some of these movies are set in Scotland, and this one was. And Lassie is owned by a very kindly Scottish doctor, a medical doctor. And the doctor, on attempting to get to a patient late on a very snowy night, falls off his horse, is seriously injured, and Lassie, of course, gets him help. And of course, that's the main point of the story, was how heroic Lassie was, but Lassie is not totally successful, although help gets to the doctor. They don't get to him quickly enough. The doctor's been ill. He's elderly. And he ultimately dies of the injury that he received on that night. But he doesn't die immediately. He's on his deathbed, and he is in the process of dying. And, of course, since he is a medical doctor, he knows he's dying. And there's two persons, so to speak, in the room with him. One, of course, being Lassie, because death scenes are very good with dogs for dramatic purposes. And the second is a friend of his. So we now have the doctor, the friend, and the dog. And the doctor announces that he's dying, and he wishes to make a verbal will and testament.
the friend mentions that he should go and perhaps get the minister, the vicar. Definitely Protestant. We're talking about Presbyterian, hardcore, Calvinist, Protestant, Scottish background here. And the friend suggests that he goes and gets the minister, and the doctor sees no need for this whatsoever. So the friend asks, should he open the Bible and read? And the doctor agrees so. And as the friend starts to read from the Bible, the camera shows a close-up of the man's hand on Lassie's head, and of course it slides off, and Lassie whimpers, and the man has died, the doctor's died. And again, it's a sort of a moving scene. It's rather trite in a certain sense, but it has a certain universality. If it's described well, you see it. It's moving. It touches us. It's a very interesting scene. A good man, a just man, a proper man has now died, and his dog feels sorrow, and his friend is there. And again, now the man, imagine the picture, the friend has the Bible open. Now he sort of closes it, holds it down, and he looks up and prays to God. And what he prays is how generous and charitable this servant was. He says, your servant, your doctor here, he didn't always charge prices, and he died on his way to try to do the service and relieve pain and stuff like this. I mean, again, totally understandable. Everything I'm saying certainly has to strike a chord with you. And then he says something like this. Lord, when you come to judge him, do so gently, and hold not against him his sins, and count instead many of his good works, because he did so many good things serving his fellow man as your steward. Now, again, the scene has a dog and a death and a friendship, and it's rather moving in a universal sense. And I want you to keep that in mind also. Two points are very important here. One is the universality of what I said. The second is sort of the emotional value of both statements. Let's examine those things. What happened in each case? In each case, the comrade of a fallen person or persons prayed to God on the behalf of the dead, the fallen. Everybody can understand that feeling, and everybody can understand the sentiment and emotion involved. Everybody. When we or any human being suffers a loss, we wish to express now our love and our concern and our regard for the person who's gone. Our very human nature, or the very most human part of our human nature, literally asks us to do something, say something. And if we believe in God and in judgment, then we sort of wish to act as a character witness, or asking mercy from the court. I've used the analogy of courts many times. We want to be a friend of the defendant. There may be something more natural or more universal than this. I don't know what it is. If there is, I don't know what it is. The concept of the eulogy is just throughout all of human cultures. It is in every work of literature. When a man dies or a woman dies, someone else stands up and speaks well for him. Even in the Hindu societies where the wife would kill herself on the death of her husband, it was an act of honor for the husband. I mean, it's a rather extreme situation, but it still is done. The pharaohs, many times, their wives and their servants would compete on who would be buried with them because it was a sign of honor. Again, this natural inclination to want to do something for the dead, departed, loved, and honorable person. And as I say, if there's anything more natural than this and anything more universal than this in human behavior, I don't know what it is. I'd like to hear it. I'd be interested. If there's anything more charitable than this inclination, and notice we're not talking doctrine here, we're talking inclinations, emotions, feelings, sentiments. If there's anything more charitable than this, but wanting to intercede for God, on behalf of someone, to God, before judgment, and I don't know what it is. Because obviously, in a certain sense, these people can't really help us anymore. They can't give us the job, they can't buy our car, they can't fix our roofs, etc. If there is something more charitable than this, I don't know what it is. There may be something more purely human than this, more purely loving, more purely kind in the proper sense of the word, but I don't know what it is. Such acts are in the highest accord with our highest emotions, in the most precise accord with our highest emotions, our highest desires, and our highest values. And that is a universal, everywhere, absolutely no exception, sentiment of human behavior. Again, not talking doctrine here, talking feeling and emotion. Now, let's suppose that there is a system which says the opposite of this. In other words, let us suppose, try to use your imagination and try to think along with me. What if everything, every single thing which you naturally, from your heart, from your feelings, which you, every single thing you hold dear, every single value which you advance, everything which makes you feel worthwhile, everything which every emotion, every feeling, every reaction, every experience has told you is good. And what if all of that, and everything you've ever learned, everything you've ever thought, everything you've ever read as truth, what if every sentiment and feeling you have goes against a system you now have to give allegiance to? Use your own imagination. How would you feel? In other words, what if, to just use these analogies, what if when you stand by the side of your dead friend or your loved one or your child, you should say nothing, and even if you feel something, even if you feel as if you should say something, according to this system, this imaginary system, you should feel as if you have just molested your own daughter or your own son. That's how bad you should feel because you want to pray for them. Now, imagine if when you were to address Congress as Norman Schwarzkopf, according to this imaginary system, you should feel as if you just burned down an orphanage and killed your mother in a wheelchair. That's how you should feel because you have violated the values of this imaginary system. We'll call it System X. Now imagine yourself in that System X. Imagine yourself totally and completely at war with yourself, literally every moment of your life. Imagine your heart yearning and asking for expression of that yearning, and your will, and your own free acceptance of System X tells you that you must never in your entire life say what you feel. You must never feel, you must never give in to the feelings that your brain and your heart and your history and your experience and your culture and every bit of art you've ever read and every bit of literature you've ever read and every single movie you've ever seen and all the philosophy you've ever read and all true religion, that all, that everything these systems tell you, you must not even give in to in your feelings. You must war against it constantly, endlessly. Imagine that. And if you don't war against that constantly, if you were to slip up like the friend at the side of Lassie's owner and pray for him, you are Judas. You are worse than Judas. Now imagine yourself in that system, System X. Now imagine even worse. Imagine as a member of System X, you must not only war against everything in yourself, you must also enslave and lie to your children. If your children wish to pray for their grandmother, you must tell them they must never even think that when your own heart cries out that you want to pray for your grandmother. And if your child does pray for the grandmother, you must severely punish her, even hit her if necessary, to prevent her from developing this feeling which your own heart cries out for. Again, you must teach them, your own children, that they must also forever be at war against everything that makes art good, literature good, feelings good, emotion good, life good. And then you must lie to them throughout your entire lives and deny that you have ever felt what you really feel. Now imagine being in System X. Now, I hope you kept the original stories in mind, because System X is Protestantism and virtually every other non-Catholic religious system that exists. Now, the reason I'm not going to deal with the ones, there are some forms, variations of Hinduism and some variations of Islam and some variations of Buddhism, which have some of these feelings reflected in them, but quite frankly, you're not going to run into those people, so let's deal with the concept of Protestantism. Because, in essence, that's what we're dealing with in America. The system X is Protestantism, which requires its people to go against every feeling they have ever had. Norman Schwarzkopf, as I've mentioned before, is a Protestant. And the man at the side of the deathbed in the movie is a Protestant. And Protestants teach its people, and tells its people that they must feel that one's salvation is determined purely by God, and there is nothing we can do to help or hinder it. They don't believe that because their hearts cry out against it. And their hearts cry out also that they should say something when people die. But Protestantism tells its people there is no purgatory. So there is no light or lighter judgment. There is no balance of good works to be counted against sins. Of course, they don't believe that because their hearts tell them different. Not even their brains, their hearts. But they have to say that. Protestantism tells its people that intercession for the dead is a foolish, stupid, and blasphemous and Catholic thing to do. And to even think about it is to betray Jesus and wander into the lands of papal Romanish superstition. But of course they don't believe that because they do it. So Norman Schwarzkopf, yeah, it is to betray Jesus and wander into the lands of papal Romanist superstitions. To intercede for the dead, to pray for the dead. And the reason they don't believe that is because there's a law written on every human heart which tells them the truth, which is otherwise. How could Norman Schwarzkopf pray that God would have a lighter judgment for those who fell in Desert Storm, when as a Protestant he believes they're either in heaven or hell right now? And as a Protestant he has to believe that they are saved, not by what they did, and not by what they didn't do, and not by what they felt or professed, or not what truth they had, because none of those have any value in Protestantism. They were in essence predestined to be saved or not. And they're automatically in heaven, automatically in hell, the instant they're dead. So how could you intercede for that? This is like interceding for a piece of lead when you drop it in the water that it might sink. No, it's destined to sink. It will do so automatically.
So the theory of predestination precludes
Of course, Protestantism precludes praying for the dead because they don't believe in purgatory. But their hearts cry out differently and they betray it every moment of their life. Why do they have funerals? Why do they have these emotional things where they are allowed to reveal their mourning in their churches when the Bible says nothing about it? Why? Two reasons. One is they make money off of funerals. And of course, they're always interested in making money and not serving God. But the second thing is, because their hearts cry out for some way for people to get together and pray for the souls of the faithful departed. Again, the man in the movie, in this Scottish Protestant culture, they could not remove the most natural thing in art. They wanted to. If they could have done it another way, they would have done it. But they were trying to sell a story and would have seen that moved people. Now imagine yourself, if you could, in that same scene with the man dying. And the man doesn't pray to God. He just closes the book and says, well, he's in heaven now. Come on, Lassie, let's get out of here. You have a tremendous gap in that movie. You don't have an emotional death scene. You haven't sold it. And why haven't you sold it? Because art, by definition, even in a movie, has to appeal to something that's universal and put into man inherently by God. And that's the point. This system X, this Protestant system, goes against the feelings which are in the nature of every single human being who's ever lived. And yet, they have to be at war with it constantly. Not even just against truth. Because truth is one thing, but feelings are quite different. You can put truth out of your mind for a long time, but you can't go against feelings. In order to remain Protestant,
Well, let me get the questions at the end, okay? In order to remain, try to remember it, please. In order to remain Protestants, they must deny their hearts and say with their mouth what they know to be lies. They must pretend to believe what no man can ever believe. Now you have an insight into the life of the non-Catholic. And when you are faced with this conflict in the form of an evangelization, the conflict between reality versus words, if you were in the Protestant system, System X, you could do only one of two things, and this is what every Protestant does. And this is important for you to understand, because in the census they fall into only one of two categories. Number one, he can ignore the words. He can wink when he says them. He can sort of inflect his voice to make it extremely clear that he doesn't believe any of this stuff, that it's all garbage, and then nobody takes it seriously. Nobody taking it seriously is a quote which I received from a Protestant minister talking about his system. Nobody takes this stuff seriously. A large majority of Protestants will ultimately tell you that if you can enter into some form of intimacy with them so that they trust you. They'll say, well, we don't take this seriously. We really don't believe it. That's one alternative. In other words, what that Protestant becomes is an institutional liar, forever dismissing the truth as having any value, any meaning, any reward, any penalty. And remember how important truth is. It's been our constant theme. The second choice he can do is he can go to war. Instead of becoming indifferent to truth, he can set out to destroy it. He can attack it, deny it, distort it, change it. He can struggle. And at least then, the very struggle gives a meaning to his life. Because now, something matters. Something is worth fighting for or fighting against. In a very strange sense, he considers anti-truth very important. This is the true anti-Catholic bigot. He doesn't care who's right, he just wants you to be wrong. He doesn't even really want to go to heaven, he just wants you to go to hell with him. He's just a pure vandal destroyer. Many times we read about the young teenagers who go wild and smash 72 windshields or slash tires, and we always say the same thing. What possesses these people? They didn't gain anything from it. What possesses them is the hatred of what is valuable, by definition. They don't go and break garbage. They don't go and attack the dump yard. They don't go in the place where the bus is already broken or the street that's on, the car that's already abandoned and set it on fire. No, they attack the new car. It is the hatred of what is good. It is pure nihilism. The hatred of truth, the hatred of reality, the hatred of God. Same thing. And again, in this case, the destroyer begins to love his lies, or he attempts to, and he embraces his bigotry as he would a lover, or he attempts to, and he seeks others by, like himself, and his hatred of truth and his feelings, in this case, hatred, and hatred sublimates all other feelings. If you really hate someone, and I mean really hate someone, and you're at his grave, the only thing you feel bad about is you can't do any more damage to him. You don't want to intercede for him. Hatred can become all-consuming. And this person's hatred of himself and God provides a motive for him to continue his life, a life which, of course, will lead to nothing and hell. But just like Lucifer, he welcomes that, knowing it's not where it goes, because he will not submit to the value of anything beyond him and his own self-induced feelings. These are quite different from the other. The feelings I talked about before come from our hearts. These come from our brains, and they kill our hearts. And this fellow's feelings, or his instincts, as you will say, come from somewhere else, not from God. And he will combat the real feelings, the feelings that show the truth of our religious system, with his mind. And with his new feelings, he will worship his own God, which is nothing but his own stomach, or Satan in one form or another. Rather than submit to the facts which pre-existed him, this concept of the emotional attachment to the dead pre-existed the life of every one of us and will go on beyond us. It is something beyond us. It is something common to human nature. If a man will not accept that, and that is the type we're talking about in the second category, the man at war with truth, at war with feelings, the man who lives for hatred, He will create his own universe. He will make himself his own God. He will interpret his Bible his own way. He will reign supreme in his own conscience. At least that's what he'll tell you. And he will reject any institution he cannot control. He will live by his own rules. And that is the two types of people. That's the type, the two types you're going to run into. You're going to run into either the one who says, none of this is really serious, and please, I don't really mean anything about it. Or you're going to run into the one who hates truth and doesn't care about what is true. He only wants to destroy. He's not the guy who steals the car. He's the guy who sets the car on fire. He's not the guy who comes into your house to steal. He comes into your house to destroy. Quite different. Quite different. But both of these people are true living examples of torment, of lies, of denial, of illness, and of loss. And the Protestant who winks at you and doesn't have the fanatical anti-Catholic and tells you he's getting along right well is tormented. Don't doubt it. It is like a lot of people who can hide their pain. And it's like a lot of people, as we, again, any one of us who knows of these things, and we all know, just being adults, every now and then someone goes crazy and shoots 15 people. It happens these days, unfortunately, at post offices, it seems. And very frequently, people will tell you, he seems so quiet, he seems so at peace with himself. This was a tormented soul who managed to hide it. We must not judge by appearances, we must judge by substance. And now consider this as the exhortation to evangelicism. These people are your brothers, your sisters, your parents perhaps, your children, your neighbors, your friends. Can you ignore the plight they're in? Understand the universal feelings which every single human being has, which all literature reflects, which all art reflects, which all philosophy and psychology reflect. The guilt for sin, the desire to continue your life beyond the grave, the desire to continue your love beyond the grave. These absolutely universal feelings are rejected by a system which then demands that these people reject everything that makes their life a value. But notice they can't even do it. So Norman Schwarzkopf, the generic Protestant, gets up there and says something universally acceptable to the entire United States and completely betrays his religious beliefs. Norman Schwarzkopf is a winker. When he said that, he winked and let everybody in the world know, I don't believe anything that any one of my many Protestant religions teach. None of us do. We all pray for the dead. You know that. I know that. Let's be serious. This is the real world. But understand, a person raising his children like that and going to a church and actually saying that he is worshiping God in a system which he rejects at the key point of his life, the joint session of Congress. Again, understand what a person like that is going through. There is no value in his life. Zero, nothing. Complete and total emptiness. Because the thing that should be formulating and creating everything, his religious system, has nothing to offer him, emotionally or intellectually. There is only one place for the reconciliation of what is most profound and universal in our feelings and what is most precise in our reasoning. There is only one place for the meeting of the universal sense of what is proper and good and our most logical conclusions as to what should be the rules of morality. There is only one place to have our sins forgiven and have our good works count for something. There is only one place where mercy and justice may both coexist, and one place where the hope of one's own life being of value can be confirmed by consistent and persistent truths. And there is only one place where charity is valued as much as truth, faith as much as effort, and where the human desires which motivate any and all of us can achieve satisfaction or knowledge that satisfaction can be achieved, and that these feelings are not wrong, but that they are proper. And that one place is the Church of Rome. Now, if you still need motivation to bring someone into the church because you don't accept that somehow it's your place,
The reason I've told you these stories is to try to point out that what I'm asking you to do is simply express your love, but use the point of feeling. If you run into a problem with doctrine, use the point of feeling. Everyone wants to pray for the dead. Everyone wants to have a lighter judgment. Everybody acknowledges that good works mean something. They feel that. Feelings are the biggest support of Catholicism, and we don't use them at all. But as I say, if you still need motivation, let me bring back a dog story. Get back to Lassie. Could you or would you pass by a dog, Lassie, who had his leg broken in an automobile accident? He lies crying, broken, bleeded by the side of the road. Would you or could you do nothing? What if it were a small bird with a broken wing in the snow in the winter? Well, the heart removed from Rome, removed from Jesus, removed from the Blessed Mother, removed from Holy Communion, removed from confession, lies broken and bleeding by the side of the road, going nowhere, just like that dog or the bird. And sometimes, as dogs have done with people who have attempted to aid them, including me personally, they will snap at you when you try to help them. That's what broken-hearted people do, too. I once advised a woman that had, I advised two women that their daughters had died. One essentially cried on my shoulder, and one got very angry at me. One committed suicide and one had died in a fire. I was not responsible at all. I was simply advising them of the information. Why did one get angry at me? I don't know. But that happens. The same reason a dog put his teeth through my wrist once when I tried to get him out of a trap. That happens. Other dogs have not. I've helped other dogs who've been injured and they haven't hurt me at all. Sometimes their pain causes an unreasonable reaction. Sometimes it's our pain causes unreasonable reactions, because pain sometimes blot out reasons. But now you know why. Perhaps they will let you lift them up because they know they need help. Or perhaps if you pass them by and they know no help, no ease, no comfort, no sense of value because no one cares enough to act, they'll just be in more pain and be confirmed that everybody really hates everyone. Everybody's wrong. There is no truth. Can you do that? Can you walk by your fellow man or woman who's sitting by the side of the road? And if you can, and if you choose to do so, well, remember this. Jesus said, at the last judgment, you will be judged by whatsoever you do for the least of his brothers, you have done for him. And whatever you fail to do for the least of his brothers, you failed to do for Jesus. Could you or would you let Jesus go to hell without putting up a struggle? He didn't do that for you, and you're called on to imitate him. It's really that simple. These people are Jesus, these people are going to hell, and these people are in pain. And if you fail to get anywhere across on the concept of doctrine, or Bible, or church, or truth, go right to their hearts. Speak to their hearts in their heads, their souls, and their minds, because they are all prisoners of that system X. And that system X will tell them always that their feelings are wrong and they must be in eternal conflict and never know peace or joy or happiness or satisfaction, but an endless guilt because what they feel is wrong. In our system, what we feel is right. Always. And you can get them, maybe, by using those approaches to get them to know the truth, and maybe the truth will set them free. And that's what your job is as an evangelist. And this whole point of this entire talk was to give you a motivation and a suggestion. And in the second part, I'll give you what I think are some very concrete techniques. But you had a question, and I think we could handle it now.
Yes, you said these people from the Protestants, they're not happy in their situation.
Yes.
And they're always in torment.
Yes.
Oh, I disagree with you. Because my husband is a convert, so my in-laws, a lot of them, and they are church-going, very conscientious church people.
very religious. They know their Bible better than I do.
No, they don't. They know the words better than you do. They don't know the meanings.
But that's where I disagree with you, that they're not
okay, fine. I understand perfectly what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I understand perfectly what you're saying. What you're saying is perfectly wrong. There are two possibilities that I can prove you wrong. I don't know because I don't know your situation, but one would be this. I have the same $100 offer always. I've made a statement. They're wrong. If you are willing, if you don't think it'll cause a great deal of disruption, let us sit down together with these in-laws. Give me an hour. An hour. If I haven't convinced you that I'm right in an hour, I will give you $100. You don't have to give me a cent.
Well, that would be impossible.
Okay, that's impossible.
It's 300 miles.
Okay, well, you know, maybe they'll come by for Christmas. Okay, no problem, no problem.
They have very loving, fulfilled lives with their children, and they go to church all the time.
John F. Kennedy went to church, and Jimmy Carter went to church all the time. If you, excuse me, you're old enough, no offense, to remember the Kennedys, Camelot. John F. Kennedy was presented as a model husband and a model father when he was a whoremonger. The point is this, I hate to say this, are you so young you have not realized that appearances are not reality? Oh, do you realize again that the guys who take the guns and shoot the 15 people, up until then, you read in the papers, people say, he was a model neighbor. We always used him as a babysitter. He was a wonderful person. Now, sometimes these people gave clear signs, but how many times do they go to their houses and they find, you know, piles of pornography and piles of strange literature, and everybody says, who would have guessed? The point is, what you are talking about is appearances, not reality. Not reality at all. Let me also point out, by your own admission, they live 300 miles away. Have you gone to visit them? When you go there, do you say, well, listen, I have a great deal of arthritis, things are terrible, and the water heater broke, and you know where things are miserable? Or do you say, things are pretty good, so happy to see you, Mom and Dad? What do you do? What do you do? No, what do you do? Do you tell them the water heater's on the blitz, and do you tell them that you're really having financial difficulties and you're worried about your son in school? And
I don't tell my mother that.
Of course you don't. Now, what makes you think she's any different from you? Why do you... do you think she's going to come and say, you know, I've been meaning to talk to you about something. We're in complete spiritual torment. We're absolutely miserable. And I thought I would come here and ruin Christmas for you by telling you that I think I'm going to hell because I think that's what grandparents should do. Now bring the grandchildren in and let me tell them I'm going to hell and let's talk about that dad has somehow contracted AIDS and will deteriorate in front of them. I think that's a good thing to talk about. Let's not sing any Christmas carols. Again, have you not realized that what we do always is we try to put on a good face with others so that they will not suffer for us? And again, how many times do people only learn in wills and testaments that their fathers didn't like them at all when they say, I'm not leaving this bum a cent? How many times, again, if you read Dear Abby like I do, I always find it interesting, how many times does a woman, thinking she had the most wonderful husband in the world after he died from the sudden heart attack, find a series of love letters he carried on with an affair with a neighbor? Appearances are not reality. The point is this, very simple. Don't, first of all, since we cannot always judge by appearances, but sometimes that's all we have to go on, fine. And if that's all we had to go on, fine. But that's not all we have to go on. What we have to go on is what I've just explained to you. I guarantee you that when your mother-in-law or father-in-law die, the other person will say in the Protestant church where the funeral is, I'm glad he's in heaven now. But if you go home, they'll do just like a woman I know, the most strongly believing non-Catholic Protestant woman ever, married 52 years to her husband. And at the funeral that I attended in that Protestant church, she stood up and said, I thank God that he's in Jesus' hands. And when I went over her house, she said, I pray for his soul. I can't resist it. I pray for his soul. Why? Because she knows that he needs help. But she stands up in front of the congregation and says the opposite. She lied.
to the congregation. Of course she lied to the congregation, because she's been lying to and from the congregation for 52 years, in that time in that congregation. She tells me, I don't believe what this church teaches, but I go there. Why? My husband likes the music. I said, you call yourself a Christian when you go to a church that teaches the exact opposite of what you believe? She said, in essence, what's the big deal about where I go? I said, what about outward witness and inward conviction? Oh, Vin, you get on these really things. Just praise the Lord, praise the Lord, praise the Lord. She's a wonderful woman. She's on her way to hell, and she'll join her husband there. There's no salvation outside the church. Because, again... No, I cannot believe you've been here for 9 weeks. Let answer a very simple question. Does truth matter?
Of course.
Then it either puts you in heaven, or lack of it puts you in hell, or it doesn't matter. Agreed?
I see what you're saying. You're saying.
No, no. Very good. But let me drive the point home. If truth matters, it either puts you in heaven, and lack of it puts you in hell, or it doesn't matter at all. Agreed?
What if you don't?
That is not what I... Then you go to hell. Then you go to hell. Very good point. Did Jesus say everybody committed to the truth hears his voice? How many times have I used that quote? Did he say that? Did he say it? Did he mean it?
Of course.
Then either he lied or these people are going, the truth doesn't matter. Understand, if you are committed to the truth, you hear his voice, or Jesus lied. There's no alternative. I know what's going on inside of you. It went on inside of me for about 3 years until I managed to burn this nonsense out. Yes, go ahead.
Believe that this Bible is
the truth. No, they don't. Not one of them does. None. I point out again, you deal with two people who you see on an emotional basis on holidays, and they're nice people. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not denying that. I've spoken to 600. You want $100? Find me one honest Protestant. One. Just one. And I'll give you $100. There are none. Understand, please, the value of what you're saying and the importance of what you're saying. Jesus says, everybody committed to the truth, hears my voice. He said it in front of Pilate. This was the reason I came onto earth, to bear witness to the truth. The truth. Everybody committed to the truth, hears my voice. The same Protestant who you says takes the Bible seriously will tell you that verse means nothing. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. Oh, absolutely.
They think that means nothing.
They believe truth means nothing. Jesus means nothing. They are virtually atheists. Do you not understand that?
No, I don't believe that they are atheists because they claim they are following Jesus.
No, 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 no. They are not following him at all because they allow divorce and remarriage in their church when Jesus forbids it. Every single Protestant denomination allows divorce and remarriage, and Jesus forbids it unqualifiedly, and St. Paul confirms that in Romans and Corinthians unqualifiedly that no Christian can get remarried if he separates from his wife. None. Now, how do you tell me they're interested in truth? It's absolutely impossible. None. How can you tell me that they have funerals in them in their churches when the Bible has nothing to do with funerals and they tell you everything they do in their church is based on biblical principles? I mean, again, I have about 13 tapes over there on Protestantism. Listen to any one of them, any one, and then tell me I'm wrong. I'm the expert in the field. You're not. You're going by pure sentiment. Again, I was young and I thought John F. Kennedy was a great guy. He was unmitigated scum. He was a weak man who gave the impression of being strong. He was a rotten, filthy, whoremongering pervert who gave the impression of being highly moral. Do you know he smoked, but they never took a photograph of him smoking because it would have been a bad image? Exactly my point. I may have to turn the tape. Hang on.
Good point. Go ahead.
Thank you. Please.
I remember Bishop Sheen. I watched him on TV.
Sure.
And he spoke one time on modern day things.
Okay.
And God had said he was one of them.
Right. So what? So what?
And I suppose he was like the rest of us.
He was fooled like the rest of us. Of course, so was I fooled like the rest of everybody else until I made it a personal inquiry. I saw Bishop Sheen before he died on Robert Shuler's Hour of Power show. Robert Shuler is a New Age atheist fanatic who masquerades as an ex-Presbyterian minister. He talks about the power of positive thinking, and I can't decide if he even believes God exists. And I saw Bishop Sheen on his show. What does that prove? Absolutely nothing. I've made mistakes in judgment too. I've bought bad cars. Okay? Why should Bishop Sheen know any more about Protestantism than anybody else who hasn't studied it? He spent no time studying Protestantism. He spent time studying Catholicism. I point out again, listen to any one of my tapes. If you find anything wrong with it, I'll buy it back at triple the price. But again, listen to one of my arguments. I have about 25 debate tapes with Protestant ministers and committed Protestants. If you haven't listened to one, I don't know what you can talk about. You're the guy who goes, you're the lady or the man who goes into the doctor's office, and the doctor takes out the x-ray and says, you've got lung cancer, you need this following treatment. And the person says, can't be. Why? Because I don't see the cancer. But we have x-rays. Sorry, doctor, I don't accept an x-ray. Because if I could see my lungs, I would know what the doctor would say, can you read an x-ray? No. Do you know what cancer looks like? No. Do you know the warning signs? No. Well, then why don't you believe I have cancer? I simply don't, because if I had cancer, I would know it somehow. Well, the doctor says, that's why I went to medical school for 12 years, just to learn that. And the other person says, well, you know, doctor, I don't think you have to go to 12 years for medical school. After all, haven't people throughout all history lived without doctors? Now you're telling me I have cancer. Well, gee whiz, I don't see why we're paying attention to you. You take the car into the mechanic, he tells you you need a new transmission. You say, no, of course I don't. And the mechanic says, but I went to school for 3 years for this. No, thank you very much. I like your opinion, mechanic. And you drive the car out and it breaks, and you die and you go in the coffin because of lung cancer. If you accept the expertise of a doctor to tell you that you have lung cancer when you can't see your lungs, and your appearances, you don't see the outside. And the same thing, there's something wrong with the transmission, you accept the word of the mechanic, then why won't you accept the word of Jesus, who speaks to everybody's heart? Again, answer my question on this, because you dodged it, you didn't. Does Jesus forbid divorce and remarriage? Do Protestants allow it?
Yes.
Therefore what? Therefore, Protestants don't value the words of Jesus, do they?
They seem to get around it.
They can't get around it. Protestants don't value the
faith.
No, they don't. They ignore it. They lie about it. Where have you been? Ask your in-laws.
Then what about the Catholic Church?
What about the Catholic Church?
There are degrees of something with marriages that are dissolved. You
never dissolve a marriage. It is an annulment. Do you know what an annulment is?
It's a thing that's been nullified.
No, it is not. No. It is a decree that no marriage ever existed. A judgment. It's immensely different. A judgment. It's a determination, like a court was. Once again, if you go into court and you're accused of a crime, and the judge finds you innocent, what he said is, either no crime ever took place, or you didn't commit it. Now, that could happen even after you're in jail for 50 years. Again, we hear these stories all the time about the innocent guy who serves 15 years in jail. He comes out and they say, we're sorry, we made a mistake. Okay, very sorry. You know, you can't get the 15 years back, but you never should have been in there. We made a mistake. An annulment is a decision that there never was a marriage. Never was a marriage. You can't annul a marriage. The same way you can't convict an innocent man, quote unquote. Okay? Now, sometimes, again, by appearances, it does appear that way. But those are not divorces. Now, are annulments, and are they abused, and do people go in there and lie? Probably. I don't know. But that's not the point. The principle is this. The Protestant will tell you that he can lie about anything and still get into heaven. Of course he will, because good works mean nothing. But Jesus says it is on your works that you will be getting into heaven or not. That's what Jesus says. I mean, again, I thought you were here for anything on salvation. Did you not go home and read the Bible and look up the quotes? The words of Jesus are extremely clear. None of those who say, Lord, Lord, will get into heaven, but only those who do the will of my Father. The Protestant will tell you the opposite. Everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will be saved. The opposite. And point was this, you still didn't answer my question. Since divorce and remarriage is not allowed, he who allows it is disregarding the words of Jesus, correct? Correct?
Yes.
Therefore, all Protestants disregard the words of Jesus, don't they?
Right.
So therefore...
Not all Protestants are divorced.
No, but they allow it. No, no, no. They, churches allow it. They follow a church which by definition rejects the words of Jesus, don't they?
Yes.
Therefore, they do not carry the words of Jesus of having any importance, do they?
Can't be.
What can't be?
That they are following Jesus.
They are not following the words
they
of Jesus.
Are,
and they know it because the words are extremely clear.
Right, because they're circumventing it.
They are not circumventing it. Just, you don't circumvent stop signs. You go through a stop sign. There's no way to circumvent the stop sign. You're using a very fancy word. They are liars and frauds and self-admitted same. By definition. I know you don't want to think about it. You're in-laws.
I'm not allowed not to call people liars because they disagreed with me.
It doesn't matter whether they No, no. It doesn't matter whether they No, you should never call someone a liar because they disagree with you. You should call someone a liar if they claim something which is not true and will not reconcile it when they know the truth. Again, a person who says he is President of the United States and not George Bush is either a madman or a liar. That's all. He cannot be nothing else. Now, if you think he's a madman, you pat him on the head. But Jesus calls people liars. Did you ever bother to read Scripture? And we are to imitate Jesus. He calls people liars all the time. He's a very harsh person. He is not gentle and kind. I don't know where people get this at all. Read the Gospel of St. John. Read it. Read it. It's right there. Start at chapter 8 and read the Gospel of St. John. He calls people who believed in him liars. His followers, he called them liars. Because they were. It's not a matter of circumvention. If Jesus says you can't do this, and they do it, and St. Paul says you can't do this, and they do it, they're not Christians. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I do everything or you do everything Jesus says, but my church says to do everything Jesus says. If their church says, Jesus says this clearly, and we can completely disregard it, we make up our own rules, they are not Christians. They do not value Christianity. Now, it didn't take me an hour, and it didn't take me anybody else here. I just proved to you that every Protestant who, quote, knows the words of the Bible, unquote, is by definition a fraud and a liar. No exceptions. Not one. None. And that includes your in-laws. And it includes my cousin, who I saw yesterday at Thanksgiving.
And that would also include a lot of Catholics.
No, it doesn't include a lot of Catholics. The reason is, we go to hell, if we do go to hell, for mortal sins or for failing to follow the correct church. They go to hell for following the incorrect church. There's a big difference. We go to hell for failure. They go to hell for intentionally going the wrong way.
But if they were born and brought up in that religion,
yes.
And always followed
absolutely.
Faithfully,
yes.
That means they're still wrong.
Yes, of course they... Right and wrong has nothing to do with what a person's background. It has to do with a fact, doesn't it? If a person is brought up to believe that 2 + 2 = 3, he's still wrong, isn't he? Okay, fact, again, I go back to it. I cannot believe none of this sunk in. The value of truth...
It doesn't sink in,
but it hasn't.
In reality...
The reality is truth matters...
Is born and brought
very good.
In a religion.
Yes.
And taught right from wrong.
Okay, fine. We're talking about an American Protestant.
Yes.
Does he read in the Bible that divorce and remarriage is forbidden?
I presume.
Okay, therefore he knows one thing if he's got any kind of a brain at all. He's in the wrong church. Now if he stays there, it is his own damnation he works out. Knowing exactly what he's doing. He may not, I concede freely, he may not yet know that the Catholic Church is correct, but he knows that the correct church forbids remarriage after divorce. He knows that because he sees it right there in black and white. And I don't care what you say, if he reads the Bible even once in his whole life, and many of them tell you they read it all the way through every year, okay, and they study it and all of this stuff, that's why I said they know the words. They don't know the meanings because they break it, they keep it out of their hearts and out of their brains. By definition, that person guaranteed 100% is rejecting truth, and if you reject truth, you go to hell. Now, I'm not saying you have to know truth, you know, you have to know the truth you're rejecting, you can just reject it, period. Again, I try to start my car in the morning and it doesn't start. What do I know? Something's wrong. Do I know what's wrong? Not yet. I know some things about cars and I might know enough to fix it. But all I know is something's wrong. Now, if I get on the phone and tell my boss, no problem, I'll be in at work tonight, and I don't come in, and then he says, why not? I said, my car wouldn't start. And he said, well, why didn't you say it would start? I said, well, I don't know enough about cars. But you know it wouldn't start. Well, yes, but that doesn't mean anything was wrong. Yes, it does mean something's wrong. If you look at your tire and it's flat, maybe somebody let the air out, maybe you got a slow leak, maybe you got a defective valve, maybe you got a puncture, maybe you got a blowout, but the tire is flat. You know something's wrong. Exactly what I said was this. Every Protestant at every funeral wants to pray for his loved one, and his system tells him it can't. Therefore, every Protestant does one of two things. Like I said, he either takes his heart and throws it out and suppresses it with his head, or he winks at you and says, like the woman said to me, I pray for him. I won't tell the congregation that. In other words, I make a lie out of my religion, and I somehow expect to get into heaven by formally declaring my entire religion, my entire life, every one of my beliefs. Again, this woman has been a Bible teacher for over four decades. Of course, what do you think? The more they study, the more evil they become. All of them. No exceptions. Did Jesus lie? Everyone. Jesus says, everyone committed to the truth hears his voice. Do you think, as it says in St. James, I've given you this quote too, and Jesus also says, if you ask for something in my name, he won't give it to you? Do you think you can ask God for the truth and wisdom, and he won't give it? Of course not. These people don't want it. You probably know the type. If you don't know the type, you certainly can imagine it. He's the guy who smokes his head off and coughs all the time. And no matter what anybody says to him, you know what he does? He opens his wallet and he takes out a yellowed newspaper clipping from the National Enquirer that shows that cigarette smoking prevents cancer. It was written in 1978 by some lunatic. He will trot it out and say, see, doctors aren't always correct. Doctors aren't always correct. You know the type. I guarantee you know the type. You'll always know somebody who says, dentists aren't going to save your teeth. All your teeth fall out. So he'll bring out another newspaper clipping where somebody removed somebody else's teeth by mistake. One dentist made a mistake, therefore no dentist can be believable. One guy didn't die from lung cancer, therefore lung cancer doesn't cause illness. One ship sunk, one plane crashed, therefore you can't go on a ship, you can't go on a plane. These are people, they don't want to know the truth, because the truth then makes them responsible. It sets them free. It also makes them responsible. And now they are free to make their own choices, and now they realize that all the evil they do needs reparation, because it always comes down to a sense of morality. Think about this. Why is it that we punish people for crimes? There's no reason, actually. It doesn't make any sense at all. You actually try to think it through. Okay, so somebody comes along and breaks your windshield. Now we throw them in jail for 5 days. Why? What good does that do? It doesn't make your windshield better. It doesn't prevent him from doing it the next time. He knows he was a jerk and shouldn't have done it. It didn't prevent the other people from doing it. And it doesn't reform him, because he comes out the same. Why do we do it? Because in our hearts, there's something called justice, which says, crime, punishment. Crime, punishment. It's very interesting. Well, every Protestant denomination denies that. They deny it, that this is the heart, this is something human. No, it's put into us by God. That's why there's purgatory. That's why we throw ourselves in purgatory. When we die, we throw ourselves in purgatory. So I'm not ready to get in there yet. Thank you very much. Just like if you came to someone's house and you had problems with your car on the way there and you were muddy for pushing it out of the thing and you came to somebody's house at Christmas, what would you first say? Please, give me a place to wash up first. And even if they said, come on in, you'd say, no, I feel very bad right now. We have senses of propriety and we have senses of justice which are ingrained in us, and they deny it all the way through. Tell me, why do they raise their children, quote, to be good? When good works don't put them in heaven and mean absolutely nothing. That's their entire theology. But they raise their children to be good. Why? Because they know it isn't true. They all know it isn't true. That's how you really know when they betray things, when they never teach their children what they believe. They don't. And that's one of the problems. How could you teach your children what you know to be a lie? You can't. Even the worst smoker in the world tells his child not to smoke. Even the drug dealer tells his children not to take drugs. Even the prostitute doesn't want his,
her daughter to become a prostitute. They don't. The criminal doesn't want, except in mafia families, the criminal doesn't want his son to become a criminal. That's the point I'm making to you.
That's why they, some Protestants are always changing churches.
They're always changing churches because somebody might have pushed a little bit, but usually the reason they're changing churches is there, it's the discomfort. I told you, all human behavior is discomfort. This is getting a little close. Maybe the minister brought up something. So they go to another one that's easier. And they keep searching the easier one and the easier one. And also the reason they change is because of social status. As you get richer, you can't remain a Baptist. You have to become an Episcopalian. You do. Rich people are not allowed to be Baptists. You have to be Episcopalian. That's nature and product. They are social clubs. Nothing but social clubs. Very simply. If you won the lottery tomorrow and won $14 million, you would have to ultimately change your friends. And you would have to get rich friends. I know, it sounds a horrible thing to say, no, it wouldn't change. Of course you would. It'd be so awkward from then on. And you would start traveling in different circles, and ultimately you'd move out of this area. And you would start joining different clubs. It's the only people you'd be comfortable with anymore. Exactly happens. Happens all the time. It always happens when people... That's the social class. Protestant denominations are nothing but social clubs. It is nothing but what music you like, what groups you like to associate with, and how wealthy you are. Or how non-wealthy you are. The theology has nothing to do with it. As I told you before, 56% of the people in Protestant denominations are there because someone invited them, not because of theology. Again, I pointed out, they grow up in one church, get married in another, get buried in another, raise their children in another, never think they've left anything. And that's the whole point. Truth means nothing. Because again, I knew a Baptist minister, probably still in that church, who doesn't believe in remarriage after divorce. Interestingly enough, he doesn't believe that a wife can leave her husband under any circumstances, although the Bible says so. So if the husband comes home and beats her up every night, she has to stay there until she dies. Very interesting. But he said 7 years ago, I used to believe differently. I said 7 years from now, will you believe differently again? He said maybe. I said, call me when you get to the truth position where you stop. But you see, he saw nothing wrong with that. And you know what? The other Baptists see nothing wrong with that. Take my word for it, or take me on this challenge. But for God's sakes, either believe me totally, or call my alleged bluff. But don't go out of here thinking that you're dealing with nice people in the sense of nice, good truth seekers. They are not. Don't ever, ever think that. Let me finish my... Here's the point. You just pick up a phone book, and you just pick a guy out, some minister anywhere, and you ask them if you can come in to discuss some religious issues. Don't mention my name because they know me around here. And just ask if you can bring a friend along. And I will give you the $100 at the end of 45 minutes. I haven't convinced you he's an evil fraud. You, your word. All I'll ask you in advance is to make a solemn promise you'll tell me the truth at the end. 45 minutes with a minister, an hour maybe with lay people.
But a minister goes through a lot of schooling, doesn't he?
Sure, he goes through schooling, in which he learns nothing.
Really?
He learns opinions. The Protestant theology schools are history schools. They are not theology schools. Luther taught, Calvin taught, Moody taught, Wesley taught. But as I asked one of the teachers once, why don't you teach the truth? He said, we couldn't. It would bring up fights. So therefore, they never resolve anything. And everything is on your final, what did Luther teach about predestination? How did he differ from Calvin? And how did Wesley modify it? Nobody says, what does God say? Nobody says, what's the truth? They can't teach the truth. Call my bluff, go to a Protestant theology school, or do like I did, just start running up your long-distance phone bills and call them up. They're listed in libraries. Just call them up and start talking to the ministers and say, how do you know you're teaching truth there? Well, you know, nobody really teaches truth anywhere. We just feel, well, what has feelings got to do with it? Well, our tradition is your tradition infallible? No, it's just the truth. We're just what we teach, that's all. But why do you teach it? Well, it's what we teach. People expect it. But is it true? Will I go to hell if I reject it? Well, no, of course not. When I was in South Carolina 5 days ago, I was with some guy who claimed to be a prophet. And I said to him, after he went through his nice, you know, fancy speech, thinking he was intelligent, and I said, can I reject every single thing you say and still go to heaven? And he said, yes. Why are you talking about it? What's the use? Why give me empty words? And that's the point. Ask your in-laws if you can reject every single thing they believe and still go to heaven. They'll tell you yes. So will every Protestant. So therefore, what they're giving you is the same thing as I could convince you that a Ford is better than a Chevy, or you should root for the New York Yankees. You can reject me and still go to heaven. Therefore, it has no value in religion. Social club. Nothing more, nothing less. And people who advance religion as social clubs are evil. They do, in the sense that they do evil acts. Because they're fraud. Are exactly the same as your in-laws. There's no difference. It's a matter of style. Style. That's all. Just style. The evangelist on TV is the same way as that very nice Methodist minister down the road. Absolutely. The one, you know, who goes to the hospitals and feeds the hungry and clothes the naked. Same thing. Don't think these evangelists on TV are necessarily in it for the money. That's an easy attack. They aren't necessarily in it for money. Several of them are in it for the love of some are demonic, some are in it for the love of evil, and some of them are in it simply for the power.
Yeah.
They don't care about the money. They live rather cheaply. A lot of ministers live rather cheaply. As a matter of fact, they don't make much money at all. But they love the power, and they love the people worshiping them. Because you think about it, if you're not going to submit yourself to God, you better make a God of yourself. Jim Jones moved all those people down to Indiana and slaughtered them all. Why? Because he wanted them to worship him. And they did. He lived under horrible conditions then. He could have lived much better back up here in the United States. He didn't care. He wanted worship. That's all. And he got it. True sense of the word. You had a question before. I'm sorry. Was it a long time ago? Too long ago?
I guess I thought that God would judge his
Mm-hmm. You're right. Can you intend to know the truth and not come to it? If you can, Jesus lied. Think about it.
I think that you can not know the truth.
Okay. Can you be committed to the truth and not hear Jesus' voice, which will then tell you that the truth matters? Because that's why Jesus came to earth. And if Jesus' life didn't mean anything, it's the whole thing again, very simply. If you think someone thinks that truth doesn't matter, then what you're saying is the feeling in their heart means nothing to them, and they're suppressing it. And God working in their heart means nothing. You tell that to someone who's gotten a paycheck or gotten defrauded on something, that truth doesn't matter. Everybody says truth matters when it's a matter of money. Everybody says that.
But they don't carry it over into their spiritual.
Why not? No, they are graced. Again, now we're back into predestination if you really want it. If God does not give everybody enough grace to make them understand that they better carry it over into their spiritual life, then he's sending them to hell through no fault of their own, and we're back being Calvinists. And we cannot believe that.
I think some people may perhaps receive grace, but like many, there's no one there.
Very good point. You're absolutely correct. Now,
therefore,
you're correct.
Therefore, will they go to hell?
Yes. Let me ask you something. Let's say you wanted to invest all your money in Pan Am right now, which is bankrupt. It is. So, I mean, if you invested your money in it, it would be rather foolish. I know, because I did that. Now, you could do it. You could call up a broker and say, invest it. But you know what? You deserve it if you didn't ask what's the status of Pan Am right now. And the same thing. If you went and looked under the hood of your... Go ahead.
Pan Am doesn't look to my intent.
Yes, it does. What was your intent?
To make money.
Right. Now, if your intent is to make money, and you know that you don't know anything about the stock market, but you're going to go into it, and you don't seek out experts, you're a fool, and you deserve to lose the money.
But how many fools are there?
A great deal. Because only the fools... Because the fool, as the Bible says... The fool says in his heart, there is no God. It really comes down, I'm sort of glad it went this way, it really comes down to a concept of atheism or not. If you believe in God, certain things follow. One is, he's all powerful and nothing is impossible. Number two, we all have guardian angels. Number three, we have the Blessed Mother interceding for us. Number four, Jesus died on the cross for every one of us. And you know what? Before you were even conceived, he knew everybody you were going to meet in your life. Everybody. Therefore, he absolutely guaranteed that you would meet enough people to put you on the right path. Absolutely guaranteed. Otherwise, we're back with Calvin. Truth doesn't matter, and people go to hell because God sends them there without giving them a chance for heaven. Absolutely guaranteed. Now, again, if you want a couple interesting stories, you read the Bible and the Acts, and what you find is, here's the Ethiopian going back to Ethiopia after worshiping at the temple, and he's reading the book of Isaiah. And what has happened? The Spirit of God moves Philip. And Philip says to him, stop. Do you know what you're reading? He says, how do I know what I'm reading unless somebody explains it to me? The Bible's difficult.
Philip says, would you like to know? He says, sure. Philip explains it to him. And the Ethiopian says, interesting. May I be baptized now? There's water right over there. Philip baptizes him. Then an angel picks up Philip and returns him to Jerusalem, and the man goes off a Catholic. Interesting. Why is that in the Bible? Here is the ignorant native going back to Ethiopia, having heard nothing about Jesus whatsoever, and God works a miracle. And what about Saul of Tarsus, who became St. Paul? He rejected the truth clearly. As he puts down, he was the chiefest of all sinners. He knew the truth if he really wanted to look for it. He could have gone to the grave and seen that it was empty. He could have gone and talked to St. Peter, but he didn't want to. He could have listened to the miracle of tongues. He didn't want to. He was the chiefest of all sinners. He was working for Satan. He wanted to destroy the Catholic Church. So God knocked him down and said, enough of this. And he said, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And he says, who are you? And he said, I'm Lord Jesus. And he said, sorry. Now, point is this. If you believe that, and you must, then those things happen all the time. And if you don't believe it, then you can't go to heaven anyway. Does God care more about Saul of Tarsus than he cares about that guy down the road? Maybe he does, but he cares enough to knock that guy down too. And many of the conversion stories I know are exactly that. A person wakes up in the morning and says, Jesus is Lord. I better get in touch with him if I want to be saved. And I mean that. They wake up that morning saying, gotta look for him. Now, if Jesus is going to die on the cross, suffer that horrible agony for, 9 to 12 hours from the agony in the garden, and then let people go to hell because they couldn't find his truth, then we don't believe in Jesus and we don't believe in God. The other alternative is, well, truth doesn't matter, and then Jesus was a liar because he said what? I came to earth to bear witness to the truth. This was right in front of Saul. This was right in front of Pilate. This is right before he was put on a cross. Everyone committed to the truth hears my voice. You will know the truth and it will set you free. He's talking to his followers. Now, there are problems mechanically on how the guy is saved in the other world, and all this stuff. And how is the guy saved in China? And I pointed out before, I did a lengthy tape on it. It takes an hour to explain it. On the Last Judgment, my view, my speculative view. But the point I come up with this is simply this. The people who do not carry it out in their spiritual life run into that eternal conflict which I just outlined in the first part of the talk. They stand by the grave and are worried because they want to pray, because they want to get in touch, because they want to keep the love going. Yesterday I was with an atheist Japanese student and I said to him, what is your religion? He said, I don't have one. So I said, well, you better have one. So why? I said, what do you think happens when dies? He kept changing his subject. Boy, other than that, he was extremely polite, very Oriental differential. Whatever I wanted to talk about, it's fine, in a nice series of questions and stuff. And Orientals ask what we consider extremely personal questions. How much money do you make? Are you going to marry this guy? Are you going to get divorced soon? Are you planning more children? Things that we consider very personal, they consider just signs of normal courtesy. But when I got on religion, he dodged it tremendously. Very upset. All of a sudden the voice took on a tinge. It took on a harshness. And his volume increased and his rate of speaking increased. Okay. So I told him, okay, something will happen to you. You'll know about it. Now, here's a guy from Japan as an exchange student in America. Well, he's the ignorant native. There aren't many Catholic missionaries in Japan. And he's raised in an atheistic household, though his mother's a Zen Buddhist, which is about the same thing as an atheist. Why did God put him in my car yesterday? Because he called me up the day before because I had met him once. Just once. And he calls me up the day before Thanksgiving. So I take him to my family's house for Thanksgiving because I wanted an exchange student to see what Thanksgiving was. God knew from all eternity that would happen. And I was just part of his plan. Now, of course, I could have rejected that and said, drop dead, Richard. But the point is, God would have got somebody else known. And from now on, Richard will be bothered very much. Until he ultimately comes into the church or dies, because God doesn't leave you alone. That's what's called a conscience. We all know that.
But I'm sure that I've read.
Go ahead.
That the church teaches that there are those people who are in the soul of the church, even though they are not in.
I'm sure you've read it too. So what? It's got nothing to do with real church teaching. Real church teaching says this, that you must absolutely, positively be submissive to the Pope in order to be saved. No exceptions. That's real church teaching.
No,
excuse me. This is fact. Again, did you get an Apostolic Digest?
I don't know.
Well, you might have got one because it's $5. It's that big red book over there. Okay, did you ever bother to look up the No Salvation things, especially like Boniface VIII, Lateran IV? Lateran IV was a universal council of the church binding forever on us infallibly. So was the Council of Florence. Council of Florence says the following, okay, that for schismatics, infidels, Jews, and pagans, that's everybody outside of a Catholic, they must become a member of the Catholic Church before their death, otherwise they are eternally damned forever, no exceptions.
Which one said
that? Council of Florence. A whole bunch of councils said that. That was just one. Again, it's in there. Look it up. And it says that if they give alms of great amount, charitable acts, or if they die for the faith, it avails them nothing. Nothing. Zero. Now, that's an infallible church teaching. What you have read is pure heresy. A lot of people like to avoid it. You know why? We live in America. We're not supposed to insult people. We're not supposed to talk about truth. There again, I ask you the simple question, and keep asking this question always. Does truth matter? If it does, there's a reward for having it. If it doesn't, there's a penalty for not having it. If there is no penalty for not having it, then it doesn't matter, and Jesus came, lived, died for nothing. Now, I know that's an unpleasant thought. I point out myself, it took me 2 years to overcome my natural, quote, natural, actually unnatural, and sinful reticence on this. Because, again, if we do not believe that Jesus can work out every man's salvation, and that's in the Bible, it says that, God has a plan by which all men may be saved and come to a knowledge of truth. And he does. Now, we're part of that plan for other people, and that's one of the reasons we evangelize, because we're going to face a horrible judgment and probably damnation if he points out all the people we were supposed to be getting to and we didn't. But as far as these other people that we never see, hey, don't worry about them. That's somebody else's responsibility. Get yourself to heaven. The church has always taught and always will teach and never has taught otherwise that you must be a member of it to be saved. Now, you're absolutely right. There are so-called Catholic theologians who write what you say and use these vague terms, and they sneak in all the time, and they are completely at variance with infallible church teachings. No exceptions. Yes.
Let me ask you.
Sure.
Why was Father Feeney silenced?
Father Feeney was silenced for a lot of reasons. The main reason, one, he was a big-mouth Irishman butting up against another big-mouth Irishman, Cardinal Cushing, at the time when the first Catholic president of the United States was being groomed. Cardinal Cushing wanted more than anything else to be standing on the podium when an allegedly Catholic president was being sworn in. Therefore, you suddenly had, right in Boston, right in Harvard, another big-mouth Irish priest running around saying you're going to hell if you're a Protestant. Well, that's the last thing a Catholic president wanted. I mean, if you know the history of the Kennedys, you know that Joe Kennedy Jr. was supposed to be president of the United States. They were grooming him. John F. Kennedy was the second stringer who came in. The money behind him, the forces behind him, had groomed John F. Kennedy for the presidency from almost, you know, from the moment Joe Kennedy Jr. died. And everything was going according to plan. And all of a sudden, Father Feeney comes out and starts disrupting everything. Now, what can you do? You can either shut up Father Feeney, or you can let this foul up and you'll never get a Catholic president. And I believe Cardinal Cushing convinced the Pope that it was a good thing to have a Catholic president. So what they did was they silenced him through the Jesuit order, and then they also condemned him through a papal office. There's no two ways about that. Those things exist. They're documentations, of course. But the Pope himself never took a side. And it's interesting because this is the same Pius XII that came out infallibly defining the doctrine of the Assumption in 1954 as necessary for salvation. Gee whiz. If the doctrine of the Assumption is necessary for salvation, then all the Protestants are going to hell who deny it, aren't they, Holy Father? And that's an infallible statement, of course. So all he really did was confirm Father Feeney. Let me give you another example of it. It might have been 1989, in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, there's a church called the Church of the Sacred Heart, and a priest there, a relatively elderly priest named Father Greasy, refused to give communion to people who came in shorts and halter tops because they thought this was disrespectful. The bishop, under whose jurisdiction he was, had put out these regulations a long time ago. Father Greasy was enforcing them. What happened? The press got a hold of it. So now when people went up to receive communion, you had Channel 5 News up there videotaping the thing and seeing him rejecting it. The bishop ordered Father Greasy to do this now. Why? Because the bishop doesn't want to run into problems when he goes and talks with his Protestant friends, and these bishops, like most other bishops in this world, are now become women, and all they care about is social contacts, and they don't care about defending the faith. Honest. Now, follow this. The bishop is disapproving a priest for following the bishop's orders. His own regulations. The priest appealed to the Vatican, and the Vatican said what? The bishop's right.
Are there politics in church?
Totally. But you see the reason why. Think about it. What would have happened if the Vatican said the priest is right, which of course he was?
The lowly guy is right?
Exactly. You know what would happen tomorrow? There'd be some radical priest in some parish giving communion to a dog. And when the bishop said don't do it, he'd say, I don't have to listen to the bishop. I can appeal to Rome. Because, I only have to listen when the Pope says so. If you understand the nature of any bureaucratic system, especially an army or a police force, very frequently, some idiot sergeant or lieutenant will make an incredibly stupid order. And some guy will disobey it. And then what will they do? They'll punish the guy for disobeying it. Why? Because if you've once established the principle you can disregard the orders of the lieutenant and wait for the captain to give them, then the next day, everybody disobeys the lieutenant. And what do? You sacrifice right, you sacrifice justice, you sacrifice everything for the purposes of keeping the bureaucratic institution together. And so what do you say to Father Feeney and Father Greasy? Suffer and offer it up. God knows what he's doing. And he does. And I'm not saying that that is the right thing to do, but I'm also saying I'm glad I'm not Pope in situations like that. I never believed in that position, but I was never in a high enough position where I had to worry about it. And that was the thing. I ran into this problem in the Army once, and I remember a sergeant gave a stupid order, and I rescinded it. And the company commander said to me, you have to back up the sergeant. And I said, no. And he said, the next time they won't listen to the sergeant. And I said, well, the sergeant shouldn't give stupid orders. And that was my view. My view was, if I as a lieutenant couldn't rescind the sergeant's orders, then I was useless. His view was, if a sergeant had no authority, everybody was useless. Because that meant an endless series of appeals. So, of course, what do you have? Sometimes, for the, quote, the good of the institutional church, you will sacrifice the individual man. But again, we've always had a history of martyrdom. And we've always had a history of people suffering the salvific. And they get them time off in purgatory, of course. But again, the Pope never condemned Father Feeney. As a matter of fact, he confirmed him in his doctrine of the Assumption. Father Feeney did nothing but teach Catholic teachings. Cardinal Cushing, of course, was a complete heretic. But Cardinal Cushing only cared about the secular concept of a close friend of his becoming president of the United States, so for the first time in the history of the United States, a Catholic cleric could be up on the podium when a president of the United States was sworn in. That's all that mattered. How many, again, you're old enough to remember, how many Catholics felt wonderful because Kennedy was elected? So did I. I fell for all that nonsense. He wasn't a Catholic. He was no more a Catholic than Sun Yat-moon is a Catholic. He didn't follow any of the church teachings at all. None. Zero. The guy was, you know, an absolute complete sex pervert. He was flying women down to have abortions in Cuba all the time. I mean, you know, he didn't do anything right. He did everything wrong. Now it's coming out. Thank God. But the point is, we all felt wonderful about it. It was an uplift. It was the so-called Catholic moment, which some people have described in this country, when it was the moment for the Catholic Church to take over the leadership of the United States and lead it into a higher calling. We do have a concept of being the new chosen people, and we should be doing that in a certain sense, but not politically, spiritually. But America, power is political. And therefore, it was, I believe, convinced, presented to the Pope that this was better. Suppress Father Feeney. Let him be quiet, and instead let Kennedy become president. And that's, of course, what happened. But as you also may or may not know, no matter what the form of suppression was, Father Feeney was reconciled in 1972 without retracting a thing. So therefore, no matter what his discipline from the church was, he was completely relaxed from it in 1972 in a very, very public, funny incident in which a Monsignor came in and talked to him and asked him to... Let's pray. So it's short. Let's pick a creed. So they picked the Athanasian Creed, one of the creedal statements of the church, which starts out with, anyone who wishes to be saved must first and foremost hold inviolate and complete the Catholic faith, otherwise he will perish eternally. As a Catholic, you must believe that creed. That's why you will never find it in a book. It's very hard to find the Athanasian Creed. Very, very hard. Because it's not popular. You'll find the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed everywhere. But the Athanasian Creed is very, very hard to find. You won't even find it in Catholic Encyclopedia. But it is one of the three creeds of the Church. And it starts out with, He who wishes to be saved must first and foremost hold complete and inviolate the Catholic faith, otherwise he is condemned eternally. You must believe that. Have you ever heard it preached? No, of course not. It's not fashionable. I hope I said it before. Style is more important than anything else that has ever affected the human race. The biggest, strongest force. It is not stylish to say these things then. Therefore, Catholics don't say them. They're not taught them. And those things, those teachings, are quite literally suppressed. But at any rate, Father Feeney said this. Then the Monsignor ran outside to the 47 press people who just happened to be outside the building and said, Father Feeney has reconciled himself to the Church. By what? By repeating what he had always said for the last 20 years. There is no salvation outside the Church. Jesus says, around John 9, that my flock know me, they will follow no others. And he says, there are others not of this flock, and I have to bring them in so they may become one. Right? One flock. Not two flocks. Those who follow Jimmy Swaggart's voice are not in my flock. Those who follow Robert Shuler's voice are not in my flock. And those who follow an Episcopalian are not in my flock. So they're going to hell, or I am. Definitely. Because otherwise Jesus lied, and then we're all going to hell. Or we're all going nowhere. Got to be one flock, one voice, one shepherd. That shepherd says, his mother was assumed from the grave, and I have to eat his flesh and drink his blood and go to a priest to get my sins forgiven. That's what I hear him say. If they hear him say something else, we're talking about two shepherds. And again, if Jesus is necessary for salvation and truth are, these people can't be saved. Now you say, again, the whole thing is, do they know what they're doing? Of course they do. Every single one of them. And once again, I got that $100, I'll put it in writing. I have no problem. I put it in writing many times. You find me the honest Protestant, and I'll give you the $100. The closest thing I found once, it's an interesting point, I found a man who I think was an honest Protestant. He freely admits he'd go to hell because he's rejecting God, because he's a Protestant. Now, I don't know how to deal with that guy. I don't know how to deal with him at all. Oh, yeah, I guess he is an honest Protestant. I say, you know, Richard, you're rebelling against God by staying outside of the Church. Oh, I'm not rebelling against God. I'm doing it because I have an immoral lifestyle and I don't want to repent, so I stay away. And I said, so if you died today, where would you go? He said, I'd go to hell for sure. Now, I guess he's an honest Protestant. I'm not sure if I can really define him that way. Though you thought he said he's an honest Protestant, the knowledgeable ones, but nobody's both. This guy seems to be both.
What denomination is Billy Graham?
Billy Graham's a Baptist.
Oh,
yes. Now let me give you a quick story about Billy Graham. Billy Graham's on a national TV show, Larry King, and he's asked about his position on abortion, and what does he say? My position is exactly the same as the Pope, His Holiness. Exactly the same. I'm against abortion, except in cases of rape and incest. That is not the Catholic position. Now tell me, could Billy Graham possibly get that wrong? You think Billy Graham, one of the great names in modern religion, would not know the Catholic position on abortion? He lied. He absolute 100% completely lied on national TV. Why? Just serving his master, father of all lies. Billy Graham's an evil man. He has to lie. These people, that's my theory. These people are compelled to lie. It's amazing if you deal with Protestants as much as I do, how they lie.
Billy Graham is an evil person.
What else do you call a person who lies about a religious truth and lies about the true Church?
I don't think he knows it.
That's the point. Think about this. What is Billy Graham's business?
Preaching?
No. Religion and money and organization. Billy Graham, you think Billy Graham, is it hard to find out what the Catholic position is on abortion? How hard is it?
Oh, everybody knows it.
Oh, wait a minute. No, Billy Graham does. Wait a minute. If everybody knows it, and Billy Graham is part of everybody, Billy Graham knows it, so Billy Graham lied. You just proved my point. Exactly. Billy Graham's not a lunatic. Billy Graham still ties his own shoes, and he still makes lots of money, and he still has a good organization. He's smart enough to know exactly what he's doing. He's the same Billy Graham, remember, who went to the Soviet Union and found no suppression of religion about 10 years ago. He went there and said they have total freedom of religion. You don't remember that either? Yeah, I know. You're making faces, aren't you? Billy Graham, like many of these people, is forced to lie because of the demons they deal with. It's a very interesting point. I pointed out, if you deal with Protestants as much as I do, you'd be amazed at what they lie at. They lie at things that give them actually no benefit whatsoever. I argue that, like the devil, they're compelled to tell lies. They can't tell truth. They always must choose evil, even if it works against them. It's a very interesting comment.
Would you hear the priest that even Cardinal O'Connor advocated listening to him because he's a good man?
Cardinal O'Connor's an idiot also. What makes you think Cardinal O'Connor's good? The church in this archdiocese stinks because we got a guy up there who doesn't have any male hormones and isn't willing to do anything. Cardinal O'Connor, when homosexuals invaded St. Patrick's Cathedral the second time, said the following. He said, "I do not agree with what you're doing, but I would defend to the death your right to do it." Cardinal O'Connor would defend to the death the right of someone to desecrate the body of Jesus Christ. Think about that. You call him a Catholic? When Bishop Weakland of Milwaukee came out and made some very compromising statements on abortion, that a Catholic politician could vote pro-abortion bills, Cardinal O'Connor said he agreed with him totally. And no. Cardinal O'Connor is not the man you think he is. He's not a man at all, really. I don't know what happened to him. The collar obviously choked out his male hormones. He's been behaving like an idiot, and he's a complete lunatic. I confronted him with the heresies in the CCD program, and I told him that he should put the nuns back in habits, and he said, "I told them they won't listen to me." Think about that. The cardinal archbishop of the archdiocese cannot get nuns to wear habits, and he can't do anything about it. Throw them out of their jobs. Okay, here's the deal. You got this position. Tomorrow you show up in a habit or I'll replace you with somebody else. Doesn't he have faith? Doesn't he think God will provide? No, obviously not. I think he's a functional atheist. That's my view. Again, when asked why he doesn't explain your matter.
I think you're radical.
Of course I am. Of course. When he was asked, you want to know, here's his full answer. When a convert friend of mine asked him why he doesn't require that the priests teach Humanae Vitae once a year as they have to preach Respect Life Sunday, this is his full answer. She said, "I am a high school graduate. I read Humanae Vitae. It is clear, concise, and beautiful. Anybody can understand it. Why don't you make the priests teach that so Catholics will understand our position on contraception?" Here's his entire answer. Next question. He shrugged his shoulders and didn't give a single verbal response. That's it. What does he do when he talks? Have you ever read his stuff? "Well, I won't condemn anybody. I won't do this. I don't condemn anybody at all." Your job is to condemn people, Cardinal O'Connor. You talk to these homosexuals with love. Have you ever occurred to you they're going to hell? Do you tell them they're going to hell? You don't. Again, what I said before at the end of my talk. The homosexual who practices his homosexual habits and now is infected with AIDS is on his way to hell. Would we let Jesus do that? What do we go to him? It's like someone told me, which I thought was interesting. They're very interested in the post-abortion syndrome in the archdiocese. They're not interested in the pre-abortion syndrome. They're very interested in helping women who've had abortions get over it. They're not at all interested in helping women who haven't not to.